I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, you know them from their cute TV and radio advertisements, but the Federal Trade Commission is none too pleased with FreeCreditReport.com. The FTC doesn't think free is quite the right word for what they're offering. We'll tell you more in a few minutes. But first, the company lost $1.15 billion from July to September and dropped market share, too. But General Motors management sounded optimistic yesterday, announcing plans to start paying back a $6.7 billion loan to the U.S. government. That loan could be paid off by next summer, some 5 years earlier than expected. But is this a smart move for a company that is still losing money and begging for a tax break from a struggling state government? We wanted to know more, so we called Jerome Vaughn. He is news director at member station WDET in Detroit. Also joining us is John Stoll. He covers the auto industry for The Wall Street Journal. He's also with us from Detroit. Welcome to you both. Thank you for joining us.
Good to be with you.
Thanks for having us.
John, I'm going to start with you. On the one hand, GM declared what seems like a big loss. $1 billion still seems like real money to me.
Right.
So how is it possible that they are in position to start repaying the debt earlier than expected, and why do they want to?
Well, basically, when GM went into bankruptcy court, the Treasury Department gave them equivalent of about $30 billion to get through bankruptcy and to survive afterward. Even with the losses that they encountered in the third quarter, it appears that they have more money on the books. So they were overcapitalized, which is a good situation to have. If somebody gives you too much money, it usually gives you a lot of options with your business. In this case, I think that GM is arguing they're doing the prudent thing, and they're going to begin taking that surplus of cash that they have and paying it back to the U.S. government.
And why do they want to? Why do they think that's prudent? I mean, we've seen where a number of the banks who also got federal bail
right.
money really just want to get out from the scrutiny of their compensation structure.
Right.
Is that
the case here?
This
will not give GM out of any scrutiny because the federal government in this case owns 60% of the company. And until that 60% stake is sold, which it could be several years, it could be as long as almost a decade until that's gone, that scrutiny will technically still be there. That could change. But we do know that really I think there's two factors here that GM's looking at when it comes to paying down the loan. One is being able to say that you're repaying the taxpayer is a tangible sign of progress when there are very few other milestones that you can point to. When you're losing $1 billion on your net basis, when you're losing market share, when Europe continues to be a problem for them, at least they can say that we're paying back our debt. The second thing is there are very high interest rates that come with this debt. I calculate that they could easily pay this thing back with the surplus by next year, in fact. And if they can get under the weight of a 7% interest agreement with the government, it will definitely help them lower those costs. And I guess there's a third factor as well. They'd like to be as private as they can be, and right now they are as public as possible. And so if they can get this debt paid back, this $6.7 billion note that they own the government – they could hopefully go out and find some banks that will lend them replacement revolving loans that then they can at least say, we're becoming private as fast as possible.
There's a question I have that I want to ask both of you to respond to. That we called Warren Brown, who is covers the auto industry for the Washington Post. He writes about cars. And he also says that it's a matter of the perception-reality gap, that GM has been turning out globally competitive products, but the public perception is not that. So that getting out from government scrutiny is one way to say that we are really back, we are strong. So is this in part about perception, John? And then Jerome, I want to hear from you.
I think there's some of that there. I don't give them that much credit at this point because I think they want the merit of their automobiles to tell the story. I think they do need to wash the stain out of the bailout off their hands. But there's also a very real feeling inside GM that they want their automobiles to stand on their own.
Jerome, what about you? How is Detroit reacting to this?
Well, I think overall we're waiting to see what's going to happen. I mean, no one has been dancing out in the street because GM lost only $1.2 billion, as opposed to $6 or $7 or $8 billion. I mean, I think people are relieved it isn't a much larger number. The plants had been closed for a while during restructuring, and no one knew exactly how it was going to work when they came back up. Cash for clunk. workers didn't have the impact for GM that it did for, say, Ford or Toyota. So I think people were holding their breath a little bit, but I think they're relieved that it was only $1 billion. It is still a large chunk of money, but that the company had the ability to spin it as progress, I think had some relief out in the streets. The other thing I think is that there were no major layoffs announced that were going to go with this quarterly announcement yesterday. And so I think that as well had an impact, an additional sense of relief on the part of average Detroiters.
But the Detroit Free Press is reporting this morning that GM may move 1,500 jobs out of Detroit, out of the Renaissance Center, and is seeking state tax breaks to keep workers there. How is that? And I understand that this is new in information, but I'm just wondering, how are people responding to that? On the one hand, the company wants to pay the federal government back, but it's still asking for concessions from state government, which is under quite a lot of pressure there owing to high unemployment. How do you think that's going to play?
Well, I think it depends on where you live in Southeast Michigan. I think if you live in the city of Detroit proper, I think people are going to be a little miffed about that. People want to see GM jobs stay in the city. People want to see that tax base that the income tax provides stay in the city. And they want to see as many workers as possible remain in the Renaissance Center, GM's headquarters. If you live in the suburb of Warren, which is just outside of Detroit, which is where the Warren Tech Center is, you want to see those jobs move to Warren because, you know, if those jobs are in Warren, that's people eating at Warren restaurants and buying gas in Warren instead of in Detroit. So we had hoped there was going to be some more regional cooperation along this line and not have this sort of territorial war. We'll see how it works out. The governor is supposed to make some remarks on that today.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're talking about the latest news in the auto industry, especially General Motors plans to begin repaying government loans, part of a government loan that it was given last year. We're speaking with Jerome Vaughn of member station WDET and John Stoll of the Wall Street Journal. John, Ford actually reported sizable profits last quarter. Ford has been kind of the, what would you say, the sort of the bright spot in the industry. Mm-hmm. What's the difference, if you would kind of help us? Obviously, there's two different companies, but what's the difference?
Ford got started a lot earlier on the real cut-to-the-bone restructuring that they needed to do. They hired Alan Mulally, an outsider who had been in the airline industry, a key figure at Boeing for about 3 decades. They hired him in 2006, and he went right about making changes that GM really is getting to now, particularly, you know, rebalancing the balance sheet, and he went out and got a lot of debt. But they began cutting, and I think it's an indication that Ford is much further along in its restructuring than GM is. GM's loss is largely attributed to the fact that they aren't as small as they promised to be yet. They're going to get there, hopefully, but they're still servicing brands like Pontiac and Saturn, which they committed to get rid of. That's very costly to run liquidation sales, so you have to incentivize the vehicles, and you're not making money on those. Ford isn't there. Now, they have a slimmer lineup right now. They have a power-packed product portfolio. And they also have a situation where people are paying more of a premium for their vehicles right now.
So, Jerome, I understand that, going back to sort of local news in Detroit, I understand that even one of the mayor's businesses is up for sale. Now, he gave up, Mayor Dave Bing, newly reelected, or reelected again. It's a complicated situation owing to the resignation of the prior mayor, Kwame Kilpatrick, because of legal problems. And so there have been a number of elections in a short period of time, but Dave Bing reelected to a full term, and he, as I understand it, gave up operational control of one of his businesses when he took the mayor's seat. But is that, you know, what does it say when one of the mayor's businesses, which had been a successful business, is now up for sale or going into bankruptcy?
Well, I think it shows that, you know, the entire industry that feeds into automotive, you know, production is on the rocks in one way or another. I mean, you know, among the products that the Bing Company made, you know, steel for automobiles and, you know, different parts to go to auto parts makers. You know, they're still struggling, and they're going to continue to struggle for a while. I mean, with General Motors cutting production earlier in the year, and many of their plants were down for for a while. That had ripple effects. The auto parts makers weren't selling parts because, you know, there was no one to sell them to. And then that rippled down the line. And the Bing company dealt with those same issues. I think the other thing it says, though, is that Mayor Bing is really looking forward. He's got a lot of work to do to help the city over the next 4 years. He's got to focus on that. And I think that's part of the message as well, is that he's really looking to focus on that job as opposed to his financial holdings.
And finally, John, I'm not sure if you know the answer to this question, but how is the United Auto Workers responding to the news about GM paying back the loan, or beginning to pay back the loan early? Are they responding favorably to this?
They've been quite silent on the issue thus far, but they do have a member of the board that represents them, Stephen Gursky. And you definitely – Steve had to be behind this. He had to vote in favor of it if it was going to happen. And you have to remember, the United Auto Workers are a stakeholder and a stockholder in GM. They own a significant percentage of the company. And at the end of the day, this will make GM a healthier – credit risk, and hopefully, for the company's sake, make them a better performer on the New York Stock Exchange when they go public. And that pays huge dividends for the United Auto Workers. So in the end, I believe that the fiscal argument is in favor of the United Auto Workers right now. And yeah, they'd like to see that in their members' pockets, but they'd also like to see the stock do well when this company goes public.
And Jerome, finally to you, and I understand that it's kind of a vague question, but can you just tell me what's the mood in the city right now? The city's been through a lot. It's been through a lot in terms of governance. It's been through a lot in terms of the industry. What's the mood right now? Optimistic, pessimistic, looking forward?
I think the mood is one of maintenance, is survival. I mean, we've gone through this economic upheaval. We still have a ways to go before we get out of it. But, Detroit has been through crises like this before, economically speaking. And so the thing is to bear down and, keep working as hard as you can. And eventually it's going to turn around. And
okay.
People have seen that before.
All right. Well, we'll keep working, too. Thank you. Jerome Vaughn is the news director at NPR member station WDET. John Stoll covers the auto industry for The Wall Street Journal. They were both kind enough to join us from the studios of WDET in Detroit. Gentlemen, thank you.
And as we just heard, the American and Chinese presidents spoke of fighting climate change, which is not going to be easy. World leaders no longer expect to agree on a climate treaty in time for a big meeting planned next month in Copenhagen. It is just as hard to build consensus inside the United States, and some environmental groups are growing impatient with President Obama. Their concern is not so much what the president does, it's what the president says and what he doesn't say. NPR's Don Gagne has our report.
It was this way during the presidential campaign, and it remains so under President Obama when making the case for reducing greenhouse gas emissions for higher mileage automobiles, or for reducing America's dependency on foreign oil. His message has been very consistent. Whenever he talks environment, he also talks about jobs.
Of energy, wind power and solar power and the next generation of biofuels, an investment that will lead to new industries and 5 million new jobs that pay well and can't be outsourced.
That is from his acceptance speech to the Democratic National Convention in Denver in the summer of 2008. This is from a weekly presidential radio address this year.
It's a plan that will trigger the creation of millions of new jobs for Americans who will produce the wind turbines and solar panels.
And this past week in Tokyo, the president looked ahead to the UN Climate Change Conference set for December in Copenhagen. He spoke of the urgency to address the problem. He said he has no illusions that it will be easy. Then came the jobs pitch.
The good news is that if we put the right rules and incentives in place, it will unleash the creative power of our best scientists, engineers, and entrepreneurs. It will lead to new jobs, new businesses, and entire new industries.
In public, the president never makes the case for addressing global warming in environmental terms alone. That bothers Damon Moglen, who works on climate change for Greenpeace.
You do not see the president doing what he has done on health care, going out into the public and explaining the problems of climate change and demanding from the Congress a science-based policy commensurate with the risks we face. We need to see much more leadership from Mr. Obama.
As for the decision to always link climate change to jobs, Moglen says,
of course there are green jobs in this process, but the fact is the president now gives speeches in which he doesn't even mention the phrases climate change or global warming.
Another environmental activist, Jonathan Lash of the World Resources Institute, says the White House approach makes political sense, especially today. He says the president is being pragmatic.
We're in the depths of the most serious recession that the United States has faced since the Great Depression. We're at 10% unemployment, and that's what Americans are concerned about. They need to know that taking action now is not something that will prolong the recession, but will help us out of the recession.
Meanwhile, in the United States Senate, Colorado Democrat Mark Udall disagrees that the White House is moving too cautiously on the issue. He says the change from the Bush administration is huge.
Were the previous administration still in office, we would be debating the science of climate change. We would be debating here whether to even send a delegation to Copenhagen. Under this administration, we're fully participating.
But Udall, who has longstanding ties to the environmental community, does say that he hears firsthand the frustration of those who insist that the president be more aggressive.
I have to defend both the president and myself in town hall meetings from people who are impatient, and I appreciate that impatience. Time is moving along, and you have a number of other competitors around the world. China, the Germans, the Danes, India are all moving very rapidly to invest in clean energy and technologies,
which he worries will give those countries a competitive advantage in the green economy marketplace. Udall says he expects the White House to step up the pressure on climate change next year, once the fight over health care is finished. Don Gagne, NPR News, The White House.
Business troubles have led to the sudden shutdown of a chain of gay publications. In Atlanta, staffers of the gay and lesbian weekly Southern Voice arrived at work yesterday morning to find a locked door and a sign posted outside saying the business had gone under. Same for the South Florida Blade. And here in Washington, it was curtains for the oldest gay newspaper in the country, The Blade, a free weekly that just celebrated its 40th anniversary. Kevin Naff was The Blade's editor. He's here in our studios. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
How did you hear that The Blade was shutting down? What were you told?
I arrived to work Monday morning about 8 o'clock and was met by two representatives of the company who had come in from Atlanta, and they informed me that we were shutting down effective immediately.
And what did they tell you about why that was?
All I know is what I was told, which was that the company had been forced into Chapter 7 bankruptcy, which, of course, is liquidation.
The company here is Window Media?
Yes.
And were there any clues that this was coming on?
Well, there were clues that there were problems, obviously, financial problems, but no one could have foreseen a complete shutdown like this. I think worst case scenario we were expecting is maybe a Chapter 11 where we could have reorganized and emerged. But this was a total shock.
What was that day like yesterday in the office?
It was awful. We've got people who have worked there literally for 35 years, have devoted their careers to the Washington Blade. Everyone was very upset. But the tone of the day started to change late afternoon. As word got out, the response from the community has just been completely overwhelming. And we've had offers for free office space, free legal services, free website development, writers who want to write for us for free. I mean, I couldn't have foreseen, you know, the outpouring from the community. So it's really been incredibly gratifying and really helped turn our spirits around.
Hmm. You know, it's fascinating to think about the evolution of the Washington Blade over the last 40 years. I have a printout of the very first edition, Volume 1, Number 1, from October 1969. It's just a typed-up one piece of paper, the Gay Blade, called then, just after Stonewall, I think.
Yes.
And, you know, the concern then was, is the government running a security check on you? Are you being blackmailed?
And to go from that in 40 years to now, we have an openly gay man running the Office of Personnel Management.
For the federal government.
Which is the federal government's, you know, basically HR department, is pretty remarkable.
And here in Washington, the city council about to approve, it seems, legalizing same-sex marriage.
Right. Who could have imagined 40 years ago?
Well, what happens now with The Blade? Is it gonna rise again?
The Blade will not, but the staff will. We have already met to lay plans for a new publication. I can't announce the name just yet.
But, oh, please.
but we're working on it. We will be putting out a modest publication this Friday. It might look similar to the very first one on that mimeograph sheet, but it will be something as a placeholder. And then the hope is that for the following week, we'd be back to a professional printing press and a full run.
What do you think the niche is that the Blade is filling, has filled for 40 years? What would be lost if the Blade were gone?
Oh, gosh. The mainstream media obviously is doing a better job covering LGBT issues, but they've got a long way to go. And the Blade is has been for 40 years, was the place to go for everything from where to find a gay lawyer who specializes in the unique needs of gay couples to what's Congress doing on our issues? What are these politicians saying about us? So it's a wide range of stuff that still is woefully undercovered, I think, in the mainstream media. So the mission stays the same. The people stay the same. The name will change. But everyone's really enthusiastic and excited, and we're ready to come back.
Kevin Naff was editor of the now-defunct Washington Blade, which will be reborn under a name to be announced soon.
And now we turn to another business that was feeling threatened recently, the oyster business. Legend has it that raw oysters are good for love, but they're also good for a fight, as the Food and Drug Administration just learned. The FDA proposed to treat oysters from the Gulf of Mexico to rid them of a potentially deadly bacteria. Then the FDA came under pressure. NPR's Debbie Elliott reports.
The FDA met its fiercest resistance in Louisiana, the nation's top oyster producer. At Casamento's restaurant, a New Orleans fixture since 1919, customers were outraged when the FDA said Gulf oysters would have to be treated from April to October if they're intended to be eaten raw. Nancy Chachery just finished off a dozen on the half shell.
It's part of our culture. It's what we eat. I mean, I remember as a child going fishing and eating oysters right out of the boat, out of the water. You know, the idea of having to radiate them or whatever it is that they want to do is ridiculous.
The FDA proposed the post-harvest treatment to curtail the average 15 deaths per year caused by Vibrio vulnificus, a naturally occurring bacteria found in warm water oysters. Vibrio can be fatal for people with compromised immune systems, including diabetics, alcoholics, and people with liver disease. But Casamento's owner, C.J. Gerdes, says he wouldn't serve processed oysters.
No taste to them. They taste like rubber. So I wouldn't use them. I would just go without.
About two-thirds of the oysters eaten in the United States come from the Gulf of Mexico. Regulators say more than a decade of trying to educate at-risk consumers about Vibrio has not worked, so they want to get rid of the threat. Michael Taylor is a senior advisor to the FDA commissioner.
We have a public health duty to act when there's a means to really prevent very serious illnesses and death.
But instead of requiring post-harvest treatment in 2011 as planned, the FDA last week did an about-face and now says it will study the feasibility and cost first. That after feeling the heat from oyster growers, consumers, and Gulf Coast lawmakers. Gulf Oyster Industry Council board member Mike Boisan says it would have been catastrophic for oyster growers. His company, Motivated Seafood in Houma, Louisiana, already treats oysters, but he says most mom-and-pop oyster shops can't afford the equipment and shouldn't be forced to.
We don't live in a nanny state. We don't have to be protected from everything. It makes no sense.
The industry's argument doesn't make sense to Jenny Bourgeois of Baton Rouge. Her father died from the flesh-eating bacteria 2 years ago after having raw oysters at his 60th birthday dinner.
I can't imagine that they would actually put an economic value over how much the lives of 15 or more individuals are worth.
Fourth-generation Louisiana oysterman John Tesfitch is one grower who says warning at-risk consumers is not enough.
That's the wrong position to take. You're in the food business.
When the public health debate over Vibrio got national attention in the mid-1990s, Tesfitch started AmeriPure, an oyster pasteurization company. Here at the Franklin, Louisiana plant, sacks of oysters are cleaned and secured with a rubber band before being dunked into a giant hot water tank.
The secret is controlling the temperature accurately to kill the bacteria without cooking the oyster.
The oyster is still raw, but no longer alive. It has a slightly stronger flavor and firmer texture than unprocessed oysters. Ameripure sells up to 20 million pounds of treated oysters a year and counts among its customers some of the nation's top seafood chains. Tesfitch thinks the industry should stop fighting health officials.
Illnesses and deaths being associated with your product keep us down. It hurts our marketability.
But the Gulf oyster industry won this round in its battle with the FDA. Debbie Elliott, NPR News.
Well, it hasn't been out a day, but 2008 vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin's new memoir, Going Rogue, An American Life, may be destined for the bestseller list already. Palin's appearance on Oprah yesterday only heightened the buzz, and given the former Alaska governor's lightning round status, it's no surprise that pundits are combing through the books for clues to Palin's political ambitions, not to mention her political prospects. But what we really want to know is the book a good read? NPR's congressional correspondent Andrea Seabrook curled up with Going Rogue today, and now she joins us to give us her impressions. Thanks for joining us, Andrea.
Hey, Rebecca.
So my guess is you have read more than your fair share of political memoirs.
A few.
Yeah. So how does Palin's book stack up?
Well, it's interesting you should put it in that context. When you're reading a political memoir, it's always a game of expectations. None of them are going to be great literature because they're out there for a purpose. They're building a character in the eye of the public or, it's sort of almost a PR game in some ways. This one is not terrible. It is folksy. It starts off with really flowery and beautiful descriptions of the sort of icy countryside of Alaska, but it quickly moves into a darker place, I think. There are occasional flashes of anger. She lashes out at everything from the ACLU to vegetarians to the Alaska State GOP to the McCain campaign to the American left. So it ends up being feeling in the end like there is a lot of pent-up resentment for how she feels she was treated by political pundits and especially the media during the campaign. And she is telling her side of the story with a vengeance.
Well, you mentioned that adjective folksy, which is one that has been applied to her throughout the 2008 campaign. Does that voice come through in the book largely? Does it feel like her voice?
It does in places. There are some really funny little anecdotes, which are the things that make you sort of keep reading. She talks about a time when she's out field dressing a moose, you know, that famous thing with her father, and her father is a teacher and says, "Here, hold these. I want to take him into school to show my class later." And he hands her a couple of eyeballs that he had just cut out of this moose, or it might have been an
elk
or
does.
Something. Right. Yeah, right. And how she was sort of like, I've got limits, Dad, you know. There are sort of those funny moments. Even when she's sort of lashing out, she's funny in the way that she was in the campaign. It's what makes her such a sort of a dazzling character on the political scene. When she says things like, "Oh, there will always be space for all of America, all of Alaska's beautiful wildlife right next to the mashed potatoes." You know, she's sort of doing that thing she does, making this joke and making a very clear political statement.
Well, dazzling, but also polarizing. We often hear you sort of lover or hater. Do you think readers will, you know, I mean, are they self-selected to already love her if they pick up the book? Or do you think?
Yeah. I mean, I think people, you know, with a character like Sarah Palin and including with her book, people will come to it with mostly preconceived notions. And the book is not going to do anything to convince people otherwise, except that even the people who hate her have this grudging respect for those flashes of sharp humor that she has. And those are scattered throughout the book. But mostly people who love her are going to find a lot of justifications for how poorly her campaign went and how badly she was treated in their eyes. And people who don't like her are going to find a lot of reason to, you know, mock the writing, you know, the sort of, in some places, it's a pretty bare American romantic story of, you know, rugged folks, hardworking, you know, it's kind of trite. It gets trite at places. So I think you're not going to change the balkanization around Sarah Palin much.
Do you feel like you learned anything new about her?
Yeah, I mean, there were places where I actually identified with her as a mother. I got a little bit more insight into that. The one thing I thought was interesting, she did a pretty good job of describing something which I think is hard for most Americans in the lower 48, or outside, as she likes to call it, outside Alaska, to understand, and that is the feeling that you can have this deep respect and love for nature and the beauty of the countryside and care for it and love it, but also believe that it is there for us to use. Drilling in the Alaska wilderness is not an anti-environmental stance in their eyes, and in her eyes, certainly. And she does a pretty good job of giving you that sense in this book. So that was interesting.
And do you get a sense of Alaska as a character or as a formative place in her story?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Everything, it's all about Alaska. I mean, it is the great big metaphor for her own personality, just sort of this rugged, individualistic. She talks about how uncomfortable she felt in those clothes that were famously bought for her by the campaign, that she, you know, there's a picture of her in an anorak that she had ducked into back to Wasilla to pick up during that campaign, and how she talks about how comfortable it was just to put her own coat back on. And there's that sense that really field dressing a moose, really, it's not just something she says, like she's actually knows how to do those things, and it's really part of her character. I think it comes across in that way, that she sort of makes this backstab at the rest of the Republican Party establishment, which she seems to believe has gone way beyond its roots of independent-minded, people.
Well, you know, I mean, the rest of the country might have discovered Sarah Palin in, you know, the summer of 2008, but she, of course, has a whole story that was going on a long time before the national press had anything to do with her. How much does that story, how does it fit with the last year and a half on the national stage?
Well, it does bring to light this sense of her character. She talks about she was a very big basketball player when she was in high school and in college to some extent. And she talks about this game her senior year in high school where her team won the state championships. This little tiny team from Wasilla, the Wasilla Warriors, I think it was called, went to the state to play off the Anchorage squad, and how there was just no way. It was just complete. It was almost a Hoosier story. There's no way these people are going to win, and they end up winning. And for the last game, she's got a hurt ankle, and she powers through it and manages to get 1 point in that winning game. And she talks about how this really defined for her the fact that you don't have to have the natural born God-given talent at what you're doing. You just have to want it more than anybody else. Again, it's a little bit trite, but it also informs the fact that she has an unstoppable personality, and she will literally power through anything that she gets her mind on doing. And I think one interesting thing, she never gives any smidgen of self-doubt in this book anywhere. There isn't the deep philosophical churning about how she believes this or that. It's completely sure of itself. She is completely sure of herself in this book, and I think that gives you a sense of the kind of political character she'll be.
The book is called Going Rogue, An American Life by Sarah Palin. Our review comes from Andrea Seabrook, NPR's congressional correspondent. Thanks so much, Andrea.
My pleasure.
Andrea joined us today from her home in Cheverly, Maryland. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
That report reminds us of the complexities of keeping a nation healthy, or making it a little healthier where possible. And we're going to talk next about the health care changes now being considered by Congress, what those changes would do and what they would not. The health bill passed by the House and a similar measure pending in the Senate would increase the number of people covered by health insurance. But critics across the political spectrum say the bills would do little to rein in runaway costs, which was the other big goal. NPR's David Wellner reports.
There's been a significant rhetorical shift in how Democrats refer to their health care overhaul. Back in July, when President Obama was still talking about what he then called health care reform, he spoke of bending the cost curve downward.
Our proposal would change incentives so that providers will give patients the best care, not just the most expensive care, which will mean big savings over time. This is what we mean when we say that we need delivery system reform.
Fast forward to the day after the House passed its health care bill earlier this month. Notice how President Obama, in praising that action, no longer called it either delivery system reform or health care reform.
It brought us closer than we have ever been to comprehensive health insurance reform in America.
Health insurance reform is the same label other leading Democrats are now using. This coincides with the insurance industry having turned against the Democrats' health care proposals, which force insurers to drop highly unpopular policies such as denying coverage because of pre-existing conditions. Paul Ginsberg heads the nonpartisan Center for Studying Health System Change. He thinks the health care makeover has ended up being largely about putting the squeeze on insurance companies.
Insurance reform is a much more accurate label, so we can praise that for the accuracy of labeling, but lament the fact that there's a lot of health care reform that needs doing, and our insurance reform will get us only so far.
And that's because while taking on the insurance companies, lawmakers are not requiring big changes in the way health care is delivered by doctors and hospitals. Those providers, in turn, are backing the health care plans moving through Congress. But their ever-increasing fees, many experts say, are driving health care costs up for everyone. Maine Republican Senator Susan Collins says those constantly rising costs are the biggest worry for people in her state.
I'm very concerned that the bill passed by the House does not do enough to lower health care costs in general. In fact, it does virtually nothing to lower health care costs.
The absence of clear measures to rein in costs is being seized on by opponents of the legislation. A TV ad sponsored by business groups calling themselves Employers for a Healthy Economy targets Maine and 9 other states.
But nothing to control rising health care costs. Health insurance costs will skyrocket. Call Congress. Tell them the new health care bill is a bill America can't afford to pay.
Even some longtime supporters of a health care overhaul are dismayed. The National Coalition on Health Care is running newspaper ads proclaiming national health care reform without cost control is like moving furniture into a burning house. Ralph Neese is the lobbying group's CEO.
Because if you have coverage, if you have other things that are very important, and the bill does, but you don't have cost containment, then you're not going to have a bill that's sustainable.
The way the system is, the more you do, the more money you make.
That's Georgetown University health economist Jean Mitchell. She finds little in the legislation before Congress that would compel doctors to stop charging for every procedure they perform, a practice known as fee-for-service.
It's almost as though patients have become like ATM machines. You know, you put them in and you try to extract as much revenue as you can.
We believe that fee-for-service is a good mechanism because it recognizes what a physician does.
That's the head of the American Medical Association, cardiologist James Rohack. Though he defends fee-for-service, he also acknowledges it gives him and his fellow doctors perverse incentives to perform more procedures than are needed.
As long as there's fixed costs, and a physician isn't able to really get paid for the true cost of care, it's created this horrible problem where physicians are pressured to increase volume just to make ends meet.
The AMA has endorsed the health care bill passed by the House, and the House in turn is voting this week on wiping out scheduled cuts in Medicare reimbursements, cuts meant to curb the exploding volume of services doctors perform. Congress has enforced such cuts only once in the past 7 years. Just as it now seems unlikely to get tough on the costly practices of doctors, who are, after all, more highly regarded than the insurance companies. David Wellner, NPR News, the Capitol.